Accession number 17395, Reel 2.
Mr. Norton, Reel 2.
Yes, you've got to go back to the camp. It says there's a big meeting for the whole company, or the whole of the forces that were in the camp, relating to career draft. I said, oh, goodness. So he says to me, why don't you sign on Private Norton, he says. Make the army, he said, you make a good soldier, he says. Make the army your career. I said, no. I said, I'm counting the days to get out. And so anyway, I made my way to the camp, and there was a big assembly. And he read out the major, or whoever it was, doing the speech. And he said, the following men will be on the career draft. I was one of them. And I returned back to him in the morning, and he said, well, I'm sorry to see you go, and whatever. He says, wish you all the best. He says, I had to leave there, go back to camp. And then we were moved. I can't remember that part, how we moved, but we went to, on the career draft, we went to Folkestone to wait embarkation. And I was at Folkestone camp as a Bedfordshire and Hertfordshire man. And we waited, and we were going one week, and we were going the Wednesday, we were going the Saturday, and every possible time we got to get home, and that was from Kent, and hitchhiked home from Kent to Yarmouth overnight, right through the night. Lifts, they used to give you a lift in them days. They could trust you, you know. You wouldn't do it today. But I've travelled from Salisbury, I've travelled from Kent, all by free lifts to Great Yarmouth, whenever possible. Made sure I was back the next day. And I hitchhiked back a lot of the times, from 6 o'clock on a Sunday night to Ravalli the following morning, and got back. And anyway, we eventually got our sailing orders, and no leave at all. And I boarded the, what they call them, boat Danera, troop ship Danera. And we sailed from Southampton, and we got to within the Bay of Biscay. And there was apparently some, I was on board boat, I believe, when the King died. We had a 2 minute silence one morning at 11 o'clock for land.
That was February 1952.
Was it? Well, I was on board boat then, somewhere. Yeah, it was in Korea, 51. But I was on board boat when they gave out the notice of the Queen, King died. Can't make it. Anyway, we had five with some trouble with the engines or something, the pumping system on the Danera, and it took 5 weeks. We stopped at Portside. I had shore leave at Portside. We then, as we went to left Portside, there was all this trouble with Farouk, and we had battle stations on board the boat, whereas if the Tannoy, the word was Farouk, if that came across the Tannoy while we were passing through the Suez, we had brain guns placed on the deck, which we had to, some of them had to handle, and the others had to lay on the deck itself. It never happened, but they were there to do. We looked over the side, and we saw the people, and they were all going British, thumbs down, British, and I only thought, oh, God. Anyway, we got through the Suez. We had to pull in the salt lakes to let other boats pass, a liner and something else, and then we were supposed to have stopped at Aden, but they reckoned it was a bit too dangerous. We got the other end of the Suez and stayed the other end of the Suez and took on water and supplies only. We weren't allowed ashore. We then got through the part of the Indian Ocean and met one big hell of a gag. We had a rough crossing through the bay, very, very violently sick, most of us. I was one of the worst, I should imagine. There weren't many worse than me for sickness. We had the same thing, as I said, when we hit the Indian Ocean, part of the Indian Ocean. I was 2 or 3 days sick there. And then we motored on to Colombo. And we had shore leave at Colombo. And then back, I sailed straight into Kure, South Japan. Disembarked Kure, South Japan. They loaded us onto trucks, 3-tonners. And we motored, I don't know where we finished up, into the Japanese reinforcement base in Kure, South Japan. And there we underwent equipment change. They took everything away from us that wasn't green. We were supplied with green underwear, green vests, and green. All our webbing had been handed in and changed over for green, from the old blanco and brass to gunmetal and green. And we had a parade every morning just to roll call. And we were allowed out into Kure whilst we were there. We were given our salt tablet every morning on parade to make sure that we took it. And that was under a strict regulation. We all stood in the 3 ranks, and an officer and a NCO came round and made sure we swallowed this salt tablet every morning whilst we were there. And then we just practically do nothing, put a little bit of parade, go down to the town. It got very, very, very cold there at nights. Very, very cold. And we had good warm barrack rooms, but there were so many blankets being pinched. You could get about £100 or something for a blanket in Kure, South Japan. And we had a barrack room which was very similar style as the Miani barrack. And they used to come in and steal the blankets. Whoever done it, Japs or whatever. And in the end, we had to have a blanket guard. There was one on each door. So we kept the blankets. We used to use great coats and things to put over us to keep us warm in spite of the central heating. Anyway, we were there for quite a while. And then all of a sudden, they said, right, you've got to go. Reinforcements for Korea. We suddenly paraded. We got already paraded into the ground. They made sure we had all the kit. Took us by lorry, 3-tonners. I don't know how many of us went in one batch, but we motored, and somebody said we'd motored through Hiroshima. Somebody said this is Hiroshima. And we motored for about, I think it was about 3 in the afternoon, till about 5. And we come to a small airfield. Never got a chance to look around, but these planes, I don't know how many planes there was, but they held about 24 personnel down each side. At least they weren't the big transport planes, they were the smaller ones. I think there was 22 of us or something, parachute on, you know, fits to the side. And we had to fly into Kimpo Airfield. Well, we flew in and we came into Kimpo Airfield. It wasn't a very long journey. And as we came in, Kimpo, I don't believe, had been taken very long. There was gunfire, there was tracer, we couldn't hear the noise, obviously not with the plane, but you could see the tracers coming over, and we thought, well, that's still under siege, you know. We said, well, they didn't give up. They landed on the airstrip. We all got out. They just tipped us out, said, right, this is your spot. The planes were gone within 5 minutes, took off again. Left us in the centre of the runway, these runways, and we were all in the centre green area of the runway. I don't know how many men there was, whether it was a company whether it was my hobby company. And where we, what we going? Two or three jeeps came up. Officers got aboard. Second lieutenants, first lieutenants, captain. Shot off. We were there. Nothing to eat. Nothing to... What were you doing? Nobody knew. No tent. No nothing. Nothing at all. And we put all the kit bags round in one big circle and sat behind them to keep warm. And we got up in the morning and nobody about, no officers, nobody. The Yanks were running the airfield. One or two of the boys were walking around with mess tins because they could see the cookhouse from the American cookhouse. They were doing the things for the RAF. The American Air Force was controlling the airfield. Apparently that had only just been taken. It was a bit knocked about a bit. And we walked about looking for somewhere or what to do. We didn't know. And a couple of boys came from the other side with a mess tin and said, "You get a breakfast. You can get a breakfast over there. The Yanks will give you a breakfast." So we rushed back to our kit bags, got our mess tins out, went into this is like a wooden hut, what they used as a... Well, this wooden hut, they had better conditions than what we had in Miani barracks. There was hot, scalding water outside for rinse, wash. And we went in and we said, "Can we have a breakfast?" "Yes, come on in, have a breakfast." So we got into this, and when we walked in, there was cornflakes, and there was all different types of cornflakes, milk, cream, sugar, jam, all on the tables. And we went round and they said, "How do you like your eggs? Sunny side up? How many do you want?" And then they'd slap your egg on, slap your egg on, and we'd sit there talking. And the Yanks came up, and we were in our BD, which was our best battle dress. And I remember two Americans come and sit near me while we were having breakfast. "What are you doing out here?" I said, "Well, we were left here overnight." And he said, "We were just saying, that BD or that dress you've got on, is that your best BD?" "This is my very, very best BD. Battle dress that I go walking and do my ceremonial parade or if ever or whatever. Yes, that is my best BD." Well, of course, their denim and their working gear was far smarter and far superior to our BD. And we went in that. We were in that. Then we had to sort of take it. Anyway, we got back to our assembly in the middle of the airfield. And we had to pull the kit at the side of the airfield, and we waited there all morning. And then all of a sudden, a lorry came up, and there was a compound wide off. And this American lorry, I believe it was, backed into the compound and tipped off a load of goodies. Well, we were like, I don't know, some like children. We all scrabbled over the wire netting and the netting and helped ourselves to whatever we could to eat. Then all of a sudden the lorries came up and we've got to get aboard. That's the first thing we'd ever... We got on board the lorries and they motored as back. We seemed to have gone backwards. And there's brown dust and what have you. We were a yellow or an orange colour when we got to where it was a transit camp. And the British transit camp. And we compared that to the one we'd got on the airfield. There was jam and stuff on the thing, full of wasps, and covered in wasps and things. And I don't know what we had to eat, typical British food stew, stuff like that. And that was about 6-7 o'clock at night. And then from then on, I can't remember what happened, where we went or what we'd done. Then all of a sudden we started to move forward, north. And we walked for weeks, days, day in, day out, digging in, defensive, digging in, moving. And we'd done that for ages. And you couldn't stop. Only arms stop here is I had prickly heat. And I had no trouble with them. Nobody ever fell out. Nobody ever dropped out and said, oh, I can't go no further. But my word, that was some of the most grueling walks and the most... We never walked on flat ground. It was always on the hills, down the hill, up the hills, and some of them hills, with your effort or with your full pack, you had a half a pup tent. You had a shovel, and one had a half a pickaxe or a handle with the thing down his back, and the other one would have two blankets, one or two bandoliers of ammunition, probably 2-3 grenades in your water pouches, and we used to put 3 grenades in them each, and we would walk. And over the hills, down the hills, up the hills, whatever the weather. I had prickly heat, and I don't know whether you've ever experienced prickly heat, but there was a lot of us had it. It was like falling in a bed of nettles with a sweaty body, and you couldn't move it, you couldn't shift it. You just had to let it go away on its own, and then hopefully they would call a halt and you would stop. But I went through that for weeks and weeks and weeks in the ground hole. Then all of a sudden we got to a position where we were attached. We were supposed to be attached to the American 1st Cavalry Division, I said. I think that was on my postcode. Well, on my postcode was BOAP3, but I believe I had to add attached to the 1st Cavalry. And what it was, we moved to this position on the Injun River.
You still with the beds and hearts?
No, that was... I forgot to mention that. When we got into Korea, they put us in some pop tents, and it was absolutely throwing it down, and they changed us over. They said, we'd gone from the Bedfordshire Hertfordshire Regiment to the Middlesex Regiment. We went over as Middlesex men, and when we got into Korea in the pop tent, they came round. It was an atrocious day, and we were all wet and weary, and they said, you're no longer Middlesex men, you're the King Shropshire Light Infantry. That was just after they lost that hill with Speakman, with the Gloucesters. And we had to go and replace the Gloucesters. I believe that was our position. We were never told much. We were never told anything, really. We just followed and done what was necessary. Anyway, as I said, we'd finally done all this walk. I don't know how many weeks, how many days, but it seemed an eternity. The nights were the terror of Korea. The nights. It was the waiting, the wandering, and two on, two off all the time. All of my time in Korea, it was two on, two off. Guard, you know, in the trench. Or
2 hours.
2 hours on. Day and night. 24 hours a day for 12 months, 14 months, 12 or 13 months. We actually come to this position. I don't know the build-up to this position, but I remember this roadway going down to the side of the engine, and the Americans, it seemed the end of the road, and they had an American command post, a little place with a guard, like a guard, and they had put a pontoon bridge across the engine, and the engine was a very, very fast flowing river. And we went across the bridge, one platoon, B platoon, I think, a B company, and there was a sand ridge that went along the engine. And about 2 miles ahead, you could just see a little village. And on the left of us, I don't know whether it was they were on the north side of the engine, because the engine was behind me, and it went buckled round. And I don't know whether the A company, that was our A company, on the hill, somewhere around about 3/4 of a mile, to our left flank. Now, I don't know whether the engine ran in front of them or behind them, but we were on this ridge, the sandbank ridge. The pontoon bridge was behind. It's a big pontoon that would carry jeeps, things like that, you know. And then there was this big rock face behind us, and on top of the rock face, on top of this one, was a whole platoon of tanks, American tanks. I think they were tanks or artillery, and they overlooked us and this vast area in front of us, with this big hill to the left, which was our A company. And they called us the Suicide Platoon. Excuse me. And we were there for ages and ages and ages. We had the slip tent from the riverside. We swam all day, every day. I was the colour of a nigger. We walk about naked. And then they made us put trunks on. You know, the officer said, you've got to put your trunk on. Always two on guard in each trench. But you were down below this sandbank. We swam in the river. And sunbathed during the day, okay. And we had this trench. There was a slip trench all the way through to this road. And then there was one there. We had our brain gun to the left-hand side and the bazooka onto the right-hand side. And we'd been there for weeks and weeks and weeks, I believe. That was the only time I saw the chaplain. The chaplain came round every weekend, more or less. I don't know whether he thought we were going to be there the next weekend. I don't know. Then we had a newspaper journalist come round. And he took our photographs. And he said to me, he took my photograph behind the brain gun. And he said to me, have you got a local rag? And I said, no. But I did. I had the Great Yarmouth Mercury. But my brother had wrote to me previously and said that don't tell too much on writing home to your mother. So I said no. But I don't think that clicked at the time. I just couldn't think of my daily newspaper, you know. So they took somebody else. I said, all right, they'll take him. Anyway, we were in this position and I'd done my stunt. There was two on that trench at that end, two on that trench at that end, with the A company way over there, and two in the bazooka on the right hand side, and then I don't know how long them trenches went that side. And we were there for quite a number of weeks or whatever. And then one night I came off of my stag, my 2 hours, came back, and on the back of the slope we had a pup tent over the trench, like near the trench. And just as I got back into my hole, the flares lit up. Oh my God. I quickly rushed back to where I just left, and my mate was on the brain gun, and he said, jabbering voices, I said, whip one, and he ripped off a whole magazine of brain, and the lights were still going up. You could sort of look around, I could see the silhouettes of all these guns and behind me. None of them opened up. None, no one to fire or nothing. But but during the evening, it didn't sound, I don't know whether it was a draw on plaster. We were never told nothing. I don't know whether it was a draw on plaster or whether it was a tactical move by the forces themselves, but that seemed so strange. We were there all that time, and this, it was like a recce, I should imagine. And this boy, he ripped off a whole magazine of brain gun. And nothing. No more noise.
What do you mean ripped off?
Oh, just fired. Complete magazine. Just sprayed it. And we had to stand to for the rest of the night until morning, 6 o'clock. Well, they looked and looked and went on it. And in front of us was the minefields. They heard one mine go off. So in the morning, they said, right, we lived on tin food all the time. I never had a cooked meal, only when I went to Japan in 12 months. Never had no cooked food. We cooked our own out of American sea ration. We had a box about three-quarter size of a shoebox. And in there had three tins of meat, ham and lima, beans and pork, spaghetti, minced loaf. And you could have those, there was three tins a day. We never went one day, I don't think, without one. Possibly one or 2 days out of the whole time. And they had three little tins of cookies. Those little, like, tiny best tin, what we used to call a tiny best tin. There was cookies in them, a jelly, a little jelly thing. Paladin tablet, I believe there was in there. Toilet paper. And we used to swap in a packet of cigarettes. Lucky Strike, Marlboro, Camel. I smoked 20 a day, and my mate's 20. a day and 50 a week senior service, British, out of a tin. The tin, we got them in tins once a week. All the time, because you were smoking, you see, you weren't allowed to strike a match, really, but you used to get down below. And, of course, I mean, that was your own safety as well. I mean, once you could silhouette, you know, but you still blew the smoke. Your hands were yellow, your lips, and as you smoked, you should puff the smoke, you know, so that wasn't sane. And, anyway, we, in the morning, we used to cook these on a little charcoal burner, the mess tins. You know, tip them into your mess tins. And of course, you'd, after a while, you'd burn your mess tin out. But there was no problem. If you wanted a mess tin, you got it. You said, when the colour sergeant came up, said, any shortages? Pair of socks, Sarge. Shirt. Pair, a set of mess tins. No forms, no rigmarole to go through and say, it was there. You got it. And they came up and they said, six men on patrol. Yeah. There was myself. Oh, there was Buck, Seaman, a Corporal Slattery, I believe it was, and another one. I would think it was seven of us. Well, you've got to go out and see what happened last night. Find the bodies or whatever. Well, seven of us talked. I think I was number six. There was one behind me, rifle, only rifles, bandolier of ammunition. And we walked for miles and right round this. I can't remember whether we went down the road or some other way round. Can't remember. We come to a place and I remember Jimmy, this boy Buck Jimmy, he stood on a tripwire. And of course, we thought we were in the middle of a minefield. The tripwire went up just a flare. We hit the deck, and we were laughing. We actually were laughing. And we hit the deck and got up and started walking again. And we walked for miles and miles and miles around this area. And then we left there about 8 in the morning, our position. And around about 2, 3 in the afternoon, something like that, dinner time, just on there, we came up to this, walked up this hill. We'd been out in this no man's land, and we came up this position, and who was up there was these Yanks, and they said, where the hell have you guys been out there? We said, we've been out looking for some bodies or something. So he says, we've had one hell of a night here, he says. And when I got up the hill, walked up the hill, there were seven of us, I walked through a graveyard. There were black plastic bags with about a dozen black Yanks dead. They'd been shelled from out there. Well, of course, we must have been seen, you know, but he's mortar. They'd been mortared or shelled at night. And there was about six of these Yanks in these plastic bags. And we had to step over them to come through, to go back to our position. And we came straight through. We didn't stop. We just came through. I suppose the bloke in charge said they knew we were coming and all that, you know. As you say, you yourself are so. We didn't know what we were doing when we go on. We got back to our position. And we hadn't been back in a position very long. And he moved. Suddenly said, we're going out. They dismantled the big pontoon bridge. The big bridge. Took that away. And the river was really running fast. And they put a little footbridge through with a handrail. And that was blowing about.